Turn your radio on.
This is a download from Triple J.
Australia's national youth network. On radio,
on TV,
and online.
For more music, current affairs, comedy, and culture,
triplej.net.au.
And now...
Dr. Carl is here. Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Did you see the lunar eclipse last week?
I'm really lame and I knew it was on and then I forgot and I totally missed it. Tell me what happened.
I lay in bed with my family looking through the image stabilised 18 by 20 binoculars in bed with my family lying on flesh, looking through the window. It was lovely, watching the shadow of the earth advance across the moon.
Was it a full eclipse?
No, it was a partial eclipse.
Okay.
And the good thing about it was that it reminded me that 2,500 years ago, the ancient Greeks could measure the distance to the moon using, number one, a coin. Number two, a lunar eclipse. Number three, a clock, which is basically just a bucket with a hole in it. You count the drips. And number four, geometry. 2,500 years ago they could do that. And I'm thinking, gee, those guys are smart. It was so nice just lying in bed watching it. And then this morning I saw the International Space Station, which apparently drops about 100 metres in altitude every day.
Wow.
It's the size of a couple of houses. It's 300 kilometres, 400 kilometres up, so there's not much air there. But on the other hand, it is moving colossally fast at about 17,000 or whatever kilometres per hour.
Wow.
And as you, of course, were about to point out, the wind resistance goes up as the cube of the speed, so it loses 100 metres a day, a kilometre every 10 days. So every couple of weeks they have to pump it up with rocket fuel to get it back into orbit again.
I was about to point that out.
Yes.
How did you know?
I was right ahead of you.
Dr. Carl is talking science with us today. We want you to ask us questions. Give us a call, 1300 055 536. If you've got an answer and you can't get through, then you can tweet at Dr. Carl, DOCTORKARL on Twitter, or you can text your answers 1975 7555 if you've got any comments for us today. Should we get into it?
In.
Okay, David from Newcastle's calling us. Hello, David.
Hello, guys.
Hello. Hi, what's your question?
I've noticed when drinking spirits and mixer drinks, obviously not naming the brand, but when I drink the diet variety, I get significantly more drunk than when I drink the full-strength variety, and I was wondering if there's any reason for that.
I doubt that it would happen. What is present in the full-strength, is it a cola or is it a lemonade-y type thing?
Cola.
If you're drinking the full-strength cola, what you have is about 15 sugars. So next time you go to a coffee lounge, you know those little cylinders, those little tubes of sugar?
Yep.
Tip 18 of those out and add them into the next drink you have. That's what you have in your average full-strength cola.
Wow.
If you have the diet, you have aspartame, or the Americans put the emphasis slightly differently as aspartame. It should really be on the antepenultimate syllable, the third last syllable, but who cares about that? There is no known mechanism that I have read whereby it makes you drunker by the diet.
Okay.
However, I could be wrong. I might have missed something. And if somebody has found anything in a peer-reviewed journal, I'd love to hear it. What you need to do is the experiment, Dr. David, where you drink and somebody does it for you, either you mix it with a diet cola or you mix it with a non-diet cola.
Write it down. Or even because you can buy little breathalyzers at some convenience stores, maybe do a breathalyzer and see if you literally are
So it could be that the sugar is in some way interfering with the metabolism of the alcohol and allowing more of it to go into your bloodstream. I haven't heard about this, but I'm very happy to learn.
We'll see if we can find out an answer for you, David.
He's trying to say something.
Go ahead, David.
I just thought because there's a lot more salt in the diet drinks, I thought that might have been something to do with dehydration and
salt.
I don't think there's sodium chloride in it. Oh.
Aspartame is a different chemical again. It's related to an amino acid.
We'll see if we can find out for you before the morning's out. Thanks for the call, David.
Thank you, Dr.
David.
See you later. Stephen's calling in from Ipswich. Hi, Stephen.
G'day, how are you?
Good. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
I just wanted to know, does tattooed skin act as a barrier towards the sun and sort of lessen the chances of skin cancer?
I haven't heard of it, but let's just run through it logically. Firstly, the word tattoo came to us from Banks and Captain Cook, and it apparently derives from the word taboo in the Pacific Islands. They observed it in their travels. Secondly, in a tattoo, the ink is in the dermis, not the epidermis. So you have at the very top in the epidermis, meaning around, epi means around. At the top, you've got dead skin cells that have no life in them, and then they're like little cobblestones, they're flat. And as you migrate down through the epidermis, you're still in the epidermis where the living skin cells are, as you migrate down, you're then into more cylindrical cells until finally at the bottom of the epidermis, you're into cells that look like columns. Now, you can have skin cancers arising there. The tattoo is in the next layer down. That tattoo is underneath.
Okay.
And so the question is, well, firstly, obviously the tattoo would protect deeper cells from turning into skin cancer. I hate to say this, but I'm ashamed to admit it, but I do not know whether the skin cancers arise from the epidermis or from the dermis. I thought that they came from the epidermis and therefore the tattoo would be underneath them, but I'd be willing to bet that there'd be a few cancers that arise from the dermis.
Mm.
And so if we could have a dermatologist or a cancer specialist, oncologist, please tell us. We'd be ever so grateful for Thank you for that.
Keep listening, Stephen. We'll see if we can find out.
Yeah.
So it could be possible to act as somewhat of a barrier.
It could. You've got to have it in the epidermis. Sorry, you've got to have a tattoo in the dermis because the top layer is continually being renewed and sloughed off and thrown away. So you want the tattoo to be permanent, although if you want to have a tattoo, which I'm not putting any moral values on.
Thanks for the call, Stephen.
Thank you, Stephen. Yes.
All right, cheers. Have a good one.
You too. Millen's calling in from Lynbrook. Hi, Millen.
Hi, Millen. Welcome.
Good morning, doctors.
Good morning. What's your question? Millen?
Yeah, nanomachines. How long before we have lovely little robots swimming around inside us?
We actually do.
Lovely little robots.
Well, if you read the latest, or if you listen to the latest Nature, there's a magazine, podcast, or if you read the magazine called Nature, or go to their homepage, nature.
I'll find
it. They're in England, and so they don't have .com, they've got .co. Which I don't quite understand.
So anyway,
we've worked out how to make a little molecule of DNA that can walk, and it can travel from here to there, getting its energy. I'm not too sure. I listened to it last night, and I was thinking, hang on, where does it get its energy from? So we have made nanomachines. Have we made them do something useful for us? Not yet. We're also heading down a different pathway where we're using nanotechnology to print machines. And to print, you know, I can get a printer. There was an article about this in Wired, which is not quite the same thing. You want machines that are really small, too small to be seen in the human eye, that can replicate themselves and do jobs.
Well, yeah? I guess, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think that they do exist, but only in a very primitive form. And I've got to read the article in Nature. I heard the podcast, now I've got to read it.
Thanks for the call, Millen.
So I failed you on three things. Oh, now I remember what I was supposed to apologize. Hookworms. Somebody rang in and said, why do people take worms? And I've been doing some reading on this.
As a cure for things.
Mm-hmm. And
this was last week.
Yeah, and I was horrified thinking, why would you take worms which can only do bad things to you? It turns out that not all parasites do bad things to you.
Mm.
They want to keep you alive so that they can keep alive.
Mm.
And parasites such as the hookworm can live for 25 years, male, female, locked in a deadly embrace for all that time while embracing and making little babies living inside you. And part of what they do for you is that they can down-regulate, they can down-modulate, they can slow down part of your immune system so you don't suffer allergies. If you've got hookworms, your chances of having allergies are reduced by 2 to 1. Mm. And remember, in an allergy, what happens is that into your nose blows some pollen. It's not a threat. Why react against it? But unfortunately, you do. Your immune system sees it as a threat and you react against it. It's the reaction that gives you great unpleasantness. So hookworms are taken by some people. There are disadvantages and side effects, of course, and one of them is anemia and there are a few other ones. But there are some people talking about it as a therapy, and I'm still a little bit confused. I'm reading up on it, so that's to just clear up what we heard last week.
All right. Dr. Carl, we were talking a little bit about whether or not artificially sweetened drinks make you drunker as mixers than normal sugar drinks.
Mm,
some thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I hadn't heard about it, but then Visual Ice Cream had tweeted me, putting me across to a link, which doesn't give us the peer-reviewed article, but the research apparently was done at the Royal Adelaide Hospital here in Australia. And apparently the alcohol enters the bloodstream more quickly. So whether you're mixing your alcohol with a diet drink or a sugared drink, when you mix it with the diet drink, for whatever reason, whether it's extra carbonation, whether it's interference with your liver, whatever the reason is not defined in this non-peer-reviewed article, whatever reason, the alcohol enters your blood more quickly and then peaks. So instead of having a broad peak like a flattened pyramid or a pancake, you've got something like a pointy, sharp pyramid, so it reaches a peak higher, but it doesn't. Of course, it doesn't last as long, but you do get that spike. It doesn't say the mechanism by which this happens. I'll have to read it up. Thank you very much, Mr. Visual Ice Cream, or Mr. Visual Ice Cream, or whatever gender you happen to be.
Daniel's calling in from Northam. Hi, Daniel.
G'day, how are you going?
Good. What's your question?
Just wondering, basically, does electricity have some form of weight? As in, when you recharge a battery, is it heavier after?
I'm thinking yes on this one. I think I was wrong about whether a hard drive on a computer is heavier.
When full?
When it has information is not. Well, this has been going through physics for ages. It's a very deep topic. With a battery, I think it's a little bit more straightforward. It's a straight E equals MC squared type thing. You've got more energy in there. You can make that energy equivalent to mass.
Yeah.
Hence, it is apparently a little bit heavier. We could be wrong, but this is what a small group of us decided at the physics morning tea.
Okay, there you go. Thanks for the call, Daniel.
Thank you,
all right,
Daniel.
See you later. Luke's calling in from Wagga. Another drinking question. It's a theme today. Hello, Luke.
Hello, Dr. Luke, welcome.
Good morning, doctors.
Morning.
Hi.
My question, me and my friends did an experiment on the weekend where we settled into a pretty responsible drinking session at a certain pub.
You called this an experiment, okay.
Yeah, the next morning when we woke up, at the end of the night, we crossed over to another pub and we seemed to get more drunk and forget a lot less after we went out into the fresh air.
Really?
It happened a few times. I'm just wondering if, does the fresh air have any kind of effect on whether the bloodstream or... Yeah,
I'm out of my depth on this one. I'm just trying to see, would it be simply being more alert, being colder in the cold night air? Whoa, I'm awake, I'm alert.
Yeah, I'm thinking the sudden surprise of being out of that warm kind of toasty pub environment where you've just been settled in and suddenly a sudden change in temperature and in environment would make you realise how drunk you were.
That could be part of it.
Being more CO2 in the air inside the pub and outside it more oxygen or...?
The amount of oxygen in the air would be pretty well the same. It'd be of the order of 20-21%. It wouldn't change a lot. What would change is your blood circulation in the pub, warm clothes. Your blood vessels to your skin would be open. And as soon as you go out in the cold air, the blood vessels in your skin close down and temporarily, for a brief period of time, they shunt more blood into your central circulation. Now, whether that causes the impression of being drunk, is it that you're more alert and you're aware of the fact that you're drunk rather than being fuzzy in a warm... I don't know. If somebody could Twitter us something on that, I'd be ever so thrilled.
We'll see if we can find out for you. Thanks for the call, Luke. If you do want to get back to us and you can't get through with answers, you can tweet at Dr. Carl on Twitter, DocTorKarl. Matthew's calling in from Rocky. Hi, Matthew.
How are you going, guys?
Good. What's your question?
I've found a few times when I've had a hot six-pack, stubbies, put them in the freezer, forgot about them for a little while, come back. They're icy cold but not frozen, no chunks of ice or anything floating around.
And then when you open them up?
Yeah, and then when I open them up, they're icy.
Now, have you been lucky enough to see the phenomenon, where a wave of iciness starts at the top and works its way down to the bottom of the bottle over a period of 5, 10, 15, 20 seconds?
I haven't. I'm just always disappointed that my beer's icy, so...
Aren't you glorying? But does it turn icy immediately or does it take a brief period of time?
Well, between the time of opening it and putting it to my lips for a drink, it's got little icy, frosty bits in it, so...
Has it turned solid ice?
No, it doesn't. More like a slushy sort of... Sort of thing, yeah, like...
Well, once again, I had a long discussion with the clever people in physics about this one, and the liquid in beer is mostly water, 95% water. I do believe that with distillation, they've managed to get beer up to about 50% or something with a brand called Nuclear Penguin.
Wow.
Why would you bother?
That doesn't sound like it would taste good.
Well, maybe. Okay, so the water, which is most of the beer, is below zero. It wants to turn into ice, but it cannot. And when, for various reasons such as the pressure, when you relieve the pressure, you put a pressure wave through it, and this acts as what they call nucleation centers. It gives it a chance. This is a really dumb explanation. It gives it a chance to freeze. You can get the same effect by dropping just a little bit of salt or sugar, and the little tiny particles act as nucleation centres and will make it freeze. I don't think we've got the full answer on this one. So, like about three quarters of the answers this morning, they're not complete.
But it's a start.
I thought it may have been, gas expands and cools. Maybe the gas coming out of solution cooled that little tiny bit more.
That's what Stephen Bosie said. That was one of the five things that I'd forgotten, yes. So, you're absolutely correct. It does cool because if you blow air out of your mouth through a small hole in between your lips, it gets colder. So you've got a lot of gas in there that's coming out, and that can also be a factor in turning it into ice. But it has to be below freezing.
Hey, thanks for the call, Matthew.
Thank you, Dr. Matthew. Thanks,
good on you. Casey's calling in from Killarney Vale. Hi, Casey.
Hi.
You've got another booze-related question for us.
Kind of, yeah, sorry. I just wondered, when I exercise, if I exercise extensively, say for a couple of hours at least, my sweat seems to give off a smell that's not too dissimilar to alcohol. It kind of smells like, like a cleaning alcohol, that kind of smell.
Mm. Like nail polish remover? Acetone?
Yeah, it's kind of like isopropanol, that kind of smell.
Oh, okay. If it's acetone, that's sort of a burning fat metabolism thing. And it's probably worthwhile mentioning that to your local doctor.
Okay.
Because it could be involved in certain abnormalities of metabolism.
Oh. Okay.
But almost certainly it's not.
Okay.
Almost certainly you're just doing a good job and exercising really hard. But it's worthwhile just checking. And I think that you're getting that from the burning of the fat, because the fat molecule looks like the letter E, and it's got three fatty acids hanging off them, and it's got a central spine, a glycerol spine, and then three fatty acids hanging off. And when they burn, they go through that stage of smelling like acetone. But I'd check further.
Maybe follow up with a GP. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Casey.
Thanks, guys.
See you later. Bye. There's a lot of talk about alcohol today, Dr. Cullen. Right. I think it's because I started Dry July today. I think my producer's being mean to me. Jody is on Safety Beach, in Safety Beach, and giving us a call. Hi, Jody.
Hey, guys. Look, I work in a wholesale plant nursery, and I was recently working on the potting machine. So the pots of dirt are coming out of the machine and heading past me on a conveyor belt. Now, when the conveyor belt or the machine was stopped for any reason, the pots would instantly look like they're all rushing back in the opposite direction, even though they're only, they're not moving.
What does it mean, Dr. Carl?
The reality of the situation is that reality is for people who can't handle drugs.
Okay.
In other words, when you're looking at reality, you look around and you see reality, wall-to-wall 3D, in colour no less. In reality, all you can see that is sharp, in focus, in colour, is an area the size of your thumbnail at arm's length. Everything else is made up. So you walk into a new environment, a room, a building, and the outdoors, and you quickly scan everything, and you build up this virtual reality, and you refresh it by looking at only with this tiny little area, and only the area you're actually looking at, specifically staring at, is being refreshed. You're seeing in real time. Everything else is in your memory banks. You're not looking at it.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And so your brain, to handle this huge amount of data coming in, it's got various tricks, and one of them is habituation. It was moving a minute ago, it'll be moving in a minute. It was still a minute ago, it'll be still in a minute. And it's when the things suddenly change over that you get fooled. One way you can see this phenomenon is if you spend a lot of time looking at a waterfall rushing down, and then just scan your eye over to the right or left of the waterfall, and blow me down, it's moving in the opposite direction. Or you're bushwalking behind somebody, and you're going up a hill, and you see the ground moving, you stop suddenly, the ground is still moving, goes in the other direction.
Yeah, because that's what's happening. It's like they're all rushing by, and you turn them off, and then suddenly they're all just flying backwards in the opposite direction.
That's right. It's just your brain trying to deal with this crazy, messed-up world where the love of a pair of humans don't amount to a hill of beans.
Oh, there you go. Thanks for the call, Jody. See you later. Ah, Jody, love that one. Michael's
trying to
calling
a bit of Casablanca there.
There you go. Michael's calling in from Perth. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, doctors. How are you going?
Good. What's Dr. your Michael? Question?
I've got a friend who's been trying to sell me on the idea of these health food supplements, and I've been doing a bit of research on the internet, and I noticed this one glutathione. It's saying that some people are using it intravenously. Some sporting clubs and that are trying to use it to see if it quickens up recovery periods after injuries. And I was just wondering, if glutathione is something that's produced in the body naturally and then we introduce it intravenously, is that going to then, if you stop using it, your body would be relying on the extra that you've been putting into it, sort of in, like a withdrawal of a drug?
That's right. In generally, if you produce something naturally and you want more of it, and so you get into your body either by eating it, drinking it, or injecting it, your body will down-regulate it. That's a technical term. Will stop making more of it, but overall, you'll have more of your body, and that you see, all that matters is that they win the next race. It doesn't matter about your long-term health. I've been seeing a sports physician. He's been telling me about how so many athletes are so fragile.
Mm.
Like when they're at their top level of peak fitness, if one of them, there's a bunch of them, if one of them has a cold, they get sent off to their room by themselves in case they infect everybody else because they're so fragile they pick up the cold straight away. And they have injuries. Look, you might get a short-term gain, and the price is really high. And is the price, winning a gold medal, worth it? Is there, in most cases, no. For Olympics, they reckon it is. They're broken down for the rest of their lives.
So in general, would taking a supplement like glutathione have any effects or any positive or negative effects?
Everything has positive and negative effects, and it's up to you to work out whether the balance works for you. In the case of people doing exercise, trying to put on more muscle, preloading with what creatine does work, but it can knock off your kidneys. Everything has side effects. There is nothing that has only good effects with no bad effects. Everything is swings and roundabouts.
Thanks for the call, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
In general, don't inject.
Dave's calling from Brisbane today. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Dave. Welcome, Dr. Dave.
Hello. What's your question?
I had to go in for an MRI recently, and they're really fanatical about metal because it's all magnetic and don't want to do myself an injury. But I had a metal dressing, a silver dressing on my thumb, and they weren't worried about that. It just got me wondering, why is it that some metals are magnetic and others are not?
The simple answer, which is very simple and slightly wrong, is unpaired electrons. Mm-hmm. A guy called Faraday a couple of centuries ago worked out there was a relationship between the following three things. Number one, electrons or charges moving in a wire. So they're the wire's not moving, but they're moving along that wire. That's the first thing. Secondly, a magnetic field. And thirdly, the wire itself physically moves. Any two will give you the third. And so by having a magnetic field and then shoving electrons through a wire, he got the wire to move, and you call that an electric motor. So going the other way, if you have electrons moving along an area and then the thing that they're in moves as well, then you've got yourself a magnetic field. And then it gets messy. You've got diamagnetism, paramagnetism, Pauli exclusion, ferromagnetism. It gets really, really complicated.
Mm.
But just think of unpaired electrons, which is what the clever people in physics to me said to accommodate my meager intelligence.
Thanks for the call, Dave.
Yeah, thanks.
See you later.
Thanks, mate.
Michael's calling in from St Kilda. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Doctor? What's your question?
It's about the Big Bang. It's probably cosmology 101, but the speed of light, they say it cannot be exceeded, yet in the milliseconds after the Big Bang, the universe went from the size of a pinhead to a basketball in, one millionth of a second.
Something
or whatever.
Incredibly short, yeah.
Yeah,
10 to the minus 30 of a second.
Yeah, but that's much faster than the speed of light.
Correct.
Is it just because the universe is expanding, it's not actually travelling anywhere, how does that work?
You're getting very close to it. Firstly, with regard to the speed of light being the absolute speed limit, when we had the mega mind meld with Kip Thorne and Roger Penrose, they said this is only a local phenomenon, that you can't go faster than the speed of light, and that things at vast distances from each other can go faster than the speed of light relative to each other, so long as they're not in contact. I'm just going to leave that hanging out there. The second thing is, you want to look up super inflation and Guth, G-U-T-H. And back in the 80s, there's a Harvard person, I think it was one of those on the East Coast where, and by the way, that part of America, the top right-hand corner of America, seems to have about 90% of all the irony that exists in the United States. He came up
with
a
recognize it.
Yeah, and he came up with a super inflationary theory where within the universe, things can't go faster than the speed of light, but the fabric of the universe itself is not limited.
So that's
and whatever it's in, and we don't know what it's in, it, as you said, it can expand faster.
Yeah,
now, read what you can about him and his books, and it's messy stuff, but it's really rewarding if you can follow through it.
Yeah, I saw the moon, the eclipse of the moon too, and...
wasn't it lovely?
It was lovely. I think it was the day after, I was driving towards Clunes, which is west of where I am, and just above the horizon, just after sunset, you can see Venus and you can see Mercury, and I think it's Venus on the horizon, which is very difficult to do. But right now, this time of year, you can see them. And if you hold your hand out at about arm's length, and it's about the width of your thumb above the horizon, the two of them.
Really?
Yeah.
Just after sunset?
Yeah, just after sunset.
I'll be out there.
Thanks for the call, Michael, and thanks for the tip.
Thank you, Dr. Michael. Okay.
Good on you. See you later. And we have Nikki from Rye on the phone. Hi, Nikki.
Hi.
What's your question for Dr. Carl?
My question is, why is Pluto a planet anymore?
Why did they demote Pluto? Well, the trouble was that originally when they discovered Pluto, they thought it was really big. And then as they got better telescopes, they realized it was small, small, really small. That was okay. They were happy with it being small. They could live with that, you know, being such a small thing. And then they discovered another rock out there with our new telescopes, another rock, planet, asteroid that was bigger than Pluto. Well, if Pluto was a planet, then they had to call that one a planet. And then they discovered another one, and now we're up to a couple of them, and it's getting really messy. And so that would mean instead of having 9 planets in the solar system, every time they got a better telescope and discovered another big rock, they'd have to make it 10, 11, 12, 13. It'd get too messy. So now they've divided them up into, major planets, which is everything except Pluto, and minor planets, which are bigger than asteroids. And we actually had on our radio show the woman called Dava, D-A-V-A, Sobel, S-O-B-E-L, who is on the Planet Naming Committee. Isn't that cool? You get to name planets. And she was one of the people who decided to fire Pluto.
Poor Pluto.
Poor Pluto, for that reason. I mean, some people are on the committee that names a street. She names planets.
There you go. That's the story of how Pluto became not a planet, Nikki. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Good. Thanks for the call.
See you.
Yep.
See you later.
Bye.
Nikki, another Nikki is calling in from Busselton. I think she might be a little bit older than that, Nikki, though. Hi, Nikki.
Hello. How are you going?
Good.
Hi, Doctor.
What's your question?
Well, I was listening to your show a couple of weeks ago and I had the door open and I was feeding the birds. And I noticed, I wondered if the birds could tell the difference between the music being played on the radio and the talking on the radio because, they sing, so they must have some concept of music.
They do. And in fact, some birds do a rather sneaky trick on their female future wives. And what they do is that when it's the mating season, they sing these songs of incredible complexity, beauty and depth. And the woman thinks, whoa, you're hot. And in an effort to try and, once they've got the female pregnant, in an effort to try and be a good bird that fights a lot, and they lose weight, they get rid of their brain. They get rid of the part of their brain that invented those songs, and so they get stupid. And it's sort of like...
They give up.
It's like marrying somebody who's really cool, and then as soon as you marry them, they get really fat and hang around in their underpants drinking beer and scratching their groin all the time.
Oh, wow.
And the person who did this research was a guy called Notterbaum, N-O-T-T-E-B-A-U-M. So firstly, the birds are very good at generating song. They appreciate song. They can tell the difference between song and voice and other noises with one of the lobes of their brain. So one part of their brain specializes in food and the other one specializes in threats. And the person who's the expert in that is Onur, O-N-U-R, Gurtigan, G-U-R-T-I-K-N. Look up Onur and left-right brains and you'll read all about this so they can tell the difference.
Thanks for the call, Nikki.
Thank you.
Thank you,
cheers.
Dr. Nikki.
Sean's calling in from Altona. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well.
Dr. Sean?
Living in the suburb that Julia Gillard calls home.
Oh, I'm not living here. I'm just working here today.
But you're not working at her house, are you?
Oh, no.
What's your question?
All right. Now, so this one, we were talking about this one on the way home from the airport the other day, and we noticed that the moon was really big in the sky. So we got onto the fact that if the moon slowly got closer and closer to the Earth, that it was, say, about a kilometre away, and we built maybe like a tower or something like that in between from the surface of the Earth to the surface of the moon with a ladder in between, If you start climbing that ladder, are you going to get to a point where you feel like you're going to start falling upwards?
Yeah, these are called Lagrangian points, after the French mathematician and physicist Lagrange, L-A-G-R-A-N-G-E. And there is a point now between the Earth and the Moon, between the Earth and the Sun, in fact, where their gravities balance out. The two factors involved are their respective masses and the distances. And so we do have some sun-staring satellites that are at the Lagrangian point. I think it's called L1. There's L1, there's L2 and 3, which are in the Earth's orbit around the Sun, 60 degrees or 30 degrees ahead and behind us, and then there's L3, 4 and 5. L1 is that distance between the Earth and the Sun, such that they're equally pulled by each, and they just sit there staring at the Sun and sending back pictures of what's happening and what's going to hit us in terms of solar weather. So, yes, as you would, if you had the, forget about the Roche's limit, R-O-C-H-E apostrophe S limit, if you had the Moon 1 kilometre above the ground and you could climb toward, there would be a point where you would hover, equally pulled by the Earth and the Moon. But the moment you got a thousandth of a millimetre either side, you then start plummeting in free fall to one or the other. It would be an unstable point.
Hey, thanks for the call, Sean.
Thank you, Dr. Sean.
See you later. Marco's calling in from the cutest suburb ever, Fairy Meadow. Where's Fairy Meadow, Marco?
Come on, I love Fairy Meadow. I lived in Fairy Meadow. It was right next to
Wollongong. In near Wollongong?
Yeah.
I love it.
It's right next to Rogie.
I've never heard of Fairy Meadow, and I feel like my day is better for it now, having heard of it. What's your question for Dr. Carl, Marco?
Well, it's kind of a bit complicated. It's maybe a more a theory or a question, but I have three kids, and I start to notice my partners sort of pick up traits that I would do, and my question is that whether when she was pregnant, whether my DNA has entered her bloodstream and picked up my DNA. Do you know what I mean?
And so she starts acting like you because of your DNA.
Well, yeah, just those sort of, I guess, transformations.
It's like Alien.
There's a lot to cover there. I've written a story about this in the ABC Great Moments in Science section called Hybrid Women.
Right.
And that's worthwhile chasing up on. Firstly, with regard to people and or pets taking on the characteristics of other family members, they do. And people, the more they live together, begin to look more like each other because they speak more like each other. They respond to each other in similar ways. It was the famous philosopher Coco Chanel who said that at the age of 20 you have the face that God gave you, and at 50 you have the face that you deserve. And so it's a mobile thing. It changes with your life experiences. Secondly, the DNA thing. With regard to chromosomes, women are XX. We've been finding some women who have been pregnant who have got XYs in them.
Mm.
And what happens is that when the man and the woman love each other very much in a special way, 9 months later we have a miracle. That's for little Nikki over there who asked about the Pluto. And there's a little miracle and the baby gets born. And the baby is half the mother and half the father. If the baby is a boy baby, instead of being XX, it's XY. And that makes it easy to identify. And some of the baby's DNA, half of which belongs to the father, sneaks across the placenta. The placenta is a wonderful barrier, but not 100%. And we've been finding cases with women with autoimmune diseases of their thyroid caused by having the baby's DNA, which came from the father, in their thyroid gland in their neck.
Mm.
So loving each other very much in a special way, pregnancy, DNA sneaks across the placenta, into the bloodstream, into the thyroid gland. So that is also a factor. But does it lead to them looking like each other? I think it's more the socialisation.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Good question, though. Thanks for the call, Marco, from Fairy Meadow.
Thank you.
See you later.
Bye-bye.
Favourite suburb ever now. Leon's on the line. Hi, Leon.
Hi.
What's
Hi,
your Dr. question?
Just curious. I've got a debate with a mate about the rate of the volume of steam that comes off a pot of boiling water. With those little steamers, you have the pot underneath boiling water and a steamer on top.
I love them.
Yeah,
they're wonderful.
Absolutely.
Yep.
I believe that the amount of water in there is fairly irrelevant as to how much steam actually comes off. I only put about an inch of water in the bottom, get it get it boiling, and then the steam that comes off that cooks the veggies or whatever up on top. But I've got a mate that, you know, he's adamant that the more water in there, the water has you know, more relevance to the volume of steam that actually comes off.
Ah.
Is it surface area or is it volume of water?
When you turn 1 millilitre of liquid water into steam, you go from 1 millilitre to about, from memory, 1,800.
Mm-hmm.
So the expansion is 1,800 to 1. I have got a steamer at home, and I'm not going to mention who it, but somebody let it run out of water and it burnt on one corner.
Not you, though.
Not me.
Nah.
I treat machines well, yeah, apart from when I treat them badly.
There you go.
I'm a hypocrite. Nevertheless, providing you've got enough water to keep on boiling, the volume of water is irrelevant. You're not going to create more steam, so long as you've got more than the bare minimum, which is a couple of mils so you don't run dry and burn the pot.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks for the call, Leon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leon.
Okay, we've got time for one more really quick one from Amy in Adelaide. Hi, Amy.
Come on,
hello,
what's your question?
My question's about dissociative disorders and what is actually happening in the brain when someone feels dissociated.
Too complicated to say. Originally it was thought that the brain was a hormone-based organ, and there was one hormone, and it was called acetylcholine. And then they discovered 2 and 3, and now we're up to a couple of hundred, and they all interfere with each other in very complicated ways. And then there are electrical fields interfering with each other, and then there are magnetic fields. All we can say is that something's going on. It's too complicated for us to know what to do. Our treatment methods, psychologists, psychiatrists, drugs, very difficult, complicated topic. Sorry. Okay.
But thanks for asking the question. Sorry. Good on you, Amy.
Thank you, Dr. Okay. Amy.
Hey, a reminder, if you've just joined us and you're thinking, oh no, I've missed out on the Science Hour, you can podcast it. It is available at triplej.net.au every week. It'll be up there later on this afternoon. And today we say farewell to Dancing Dan, our webcam
Dancing
man, who
Dan.
For many years has been doing the podcast for you to listen to every week. He is moving away from the ABC, moving away from us, and we're very sad.
He's moving to a country, the part of the world which has got probably the cleanest air on the whole planet, and that part of Australia is called
Tasmania.
Yes,
he's going to be better off without us. Is what you're saying, Dr. Carl?
But he'll be without us. We'll miss you, Dan.
We love you, Dan. Thank you.
We love you, Dan. Thank you for being nice to us all those years.
Thank you for being a science nerd who dances.
And we're jealous that you're in the clean air.
Thank you, Dr. Carl. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Dr. Dan.